Okay, so everybody, welcome to Santi for the evening talk, Saturday night talk. And during the Brains Retreat, I'm endeavouring to maintain a certain level of sort of cohesion and development in the series of talks that we're giving, trying to build up little bit by little bit a picture of the practice. And I try to do that reasonably systematically, but not too systematically. Because when you make it too systematic, then it becomes like a formula. And when it becomes a formula, then it doesn't breathe anymore, doesn't live anymore. So it has to be systematic enough to make sense, but unsystematic enough that there's some wiggle room. So this evening, as far as metta meditation, if you remember last week, we went up to, I believe, to the second person, metta for the loved one. So now we're ready to do loving kindness for the third person, a neutral person. But there's a problem, and the problem is that neutral people are boring. That's why they're neutral. Yeah? So if when you develop loving kindness for neutral people, your mind tends to become bored. Your mind tends to slip off that object that you're trying to develop it for. And you're not really interested in doing it. You're not really interested in actually accomplishing it. You don't really want to have metta for that person. And so when moving from metta for the second person, for the loved person, to doing loving kindness for the third one, the neutral person, then very often you'll find that the energy in your mind will drop down. The mind will drift, it will not stay with the object, and it will just kind of slide almost without noticing it. It will slide into naughty land. And there goes your attempt at developing the path. So in order to counteract this, my teacher Ajahn Mahachatjai strongly recommends that when you reach that stage in your meditation, if you're ready to do metta for the third stage, you should also do another practice to begin your meditation, and the practice of developing the four iddhi-bhavas, okay? And by coincidence, as some may see, by coincidence, this topic for the main talk is the four iddhi-bhavas today. And we've reached that point, so now we can do the iddhi-bhavas in the meditation. And we'll also have the talk also about the iddhi-bhavas, the basis of psychic power. So for now, I'm not going to talk about them too much in detail, but just enough to understand what they are. So the iddhi-bhavas, chanda is enthusiasm or desire. Okay, virya is energy, citta is mind or consciousness, and vimamsa is inquiry. Okay, these four dhammas, four mental qualities. So like all of the things that the Buddha taught in the Eightfold Path, the basic factors of the path are things that are very apparent. There isn't like this kind of mystical secret doctrine or anything like that. Enthusiasm, energy, awareness, and inquiry or investigation. So what we're going to do now is a short meditation for about 15 minutes or so, where we will try to awaken these four factors in our mind. Try to awaken these and use them to empower our minds. Okay, so I ask you to sit prepared for meditation. As always, you sit comfortably and alert, and your body feeling composed and balanced. not dying and dredging up the past. Not running off into the future. Getting in touch with the here and the now. Knowing what is. Feelings in your body. Starts to think about this and that. You just notice it, thinking. And then let it go. Thinking. Noticing the mood that you bring into the meditation. Nervousness, doubt, fear, joy, excitement, depression, whatever that mood is, just notice and let it go. reasonably collected and balanced, we can start developing the four Ihipadas. Firstly, simply bring the first one of these Ihipadas to mind, Chanda, the translator's enthusiasm, or zeal, or desire, or interest, aspiration, whichever word is most evocative for you, you can use to bring these qualities to mind. Do you really want to practice? Do you have that in you, that feeling? Do you want to see the truth? Do you want to have a peaceful mind? Do you want to lift your mind up out of this mire, out of this mud, and bring it to somewhere very pure and beautiful? Do you have that desire, that aspiration? Keep on asking yourself this. Do I have that? Do I have that aspiration? Where is it? It's there somewhere. If you didn't have it, you wouldn't be here in this room. Keep on repeating over and over to yourself, do I have that? Do I have that aspiration? Do I have that desire for the Dhamma? Do I have that love of the Dhamma? Try and awaken that quality in you, bringing it up. Filling your whole body with that feeling, like that urgency, wanting to practice, wanting to meditate, wanting to purify the mind, wanting to see the truth. Keep on filling your mind and your body with that feeling, until it feels like overwhelming, like it's going to overflow. Keep on filling it up, filling it up, filling it up. Set your mind on that idea of Dhamma that you have in your heart. Set your mind on that. Set your aspirations on that. Remind yourself of why you originally wanted to practice Dhamma. Why you saw that there was suffering and you wanted to get out of it. Keep reminding yourself of that and bring up an aspiration. Remind yourself of that fear you have of death, of the unknown, and that your desire to practice Dhamma, to get over that, to get beyond that, all that suffering and confusion. Where is it? Where is that spark that is going to lift you out? And you can feel that clearly in yourself and move to the second of the Ihipadas, Virya. You feel that sense of energy, a sense of sustained flow of effort. energy, virya, is the one that will not stop no matter what. The one that just keeps on going. That power within you, that force within you, that will just keep on going, keep on going, keep on going. No matter what the cost, no matter what you have to leave behind, no matter what obstacles you have to overcome. Ask yourself, do I have that energy? Where is that energy? All of you have that energy. If you don't have energy, you'd be lying down dead on the floor. You have energy there in your body, in your mind. And tap into that and use that, turn that energy towards the Dhamma. This is this virya idipada. Feel that strong energy and move to the third of your deep artists, citta, the mind. This one is much softer than that energy, much more gentle. And citta is that very, very almost passive, receptive sense of awareness. It's not going out to get anything. It's just sitting there in the middle, knowing. Try to feel that out. That center inside you, inside your heart. Not in your brain, in your heart. Very pure and bright. Whatever sounds come in, this is the one that knows those. Whatever feelings in your body, not the feelings, but the one who knows the feeling. Whatever thoughts in the mind, not those thoughts, but the one who knows those thoughts. nipada, mimamsa, inquiry, investigation. A very active, kind of probing sense of the mind. This reflects back on those first three idipadas. Reflect back on each one of those in turn and ask yourself, did I have those? To what extent were they there? What brought them up? What made them increase? What stopped them? Investigating into each of these things. Did I have that enthusiasm, that aspiration, that desire for the Dhamma? How did I contact that? Where did it come from? What did it feel like? What did it make me want to do? The energy, what was that like? Did I feel anything there? What was that sense in my mind? How did I contact that? How can I make that bigger? The citta, where was that? Where was the citta? Where was the citta sitting? How did I get in contact with that? And what's the relationship between these things? How do they connect to each other? How do they condition each other? Finally, we can dedicate the merits of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings rejoice. And the merit we made through our practice, may all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu. And you can come out of meditation. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Chanda samadhi padana sankhara samanagatam dhipadam. Virya samadhi padana sankhara samanagatam dhipadam. Chitta samadhi padana sankhara samanagatam dhipadam. Imamsa samadhi padana sankhara samanagatam dhipadam. So in the Buddha's teachings on the path, which he summarized as the 37 wings to awakening, bodhipakkhiya dhammas, the idipadas, the four idipadas, constitute one group among the seven groups that make up the bodhipakkhiya dhammas. Actually, I've teetered a little bit after finishing talking about Satipatthana last week. I should have talked about the four right efforts this week, but I can include those with one of the other groups later on. When we look at each of these groups of dhammas, of course there's much overlap. They have much in common. Certainly we can't say that these groups sort of constitute a gradual or sequential path. You don't do one and then the next and then the next and so on. It's not like that. There is a graduated sequence within many of the groups, but not in the set of 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas as a whole. It was never meant in that way. So each set of Dhammas, while having much in common with the others, also has its own characteristic focus, its own characteristic perspective on the path. And this is why it's useful for some people to focus more on certain teachings rather than on other ones. And for some people, maybe find certain teachings very inspiring, very useful, like to take that up and practice it. Other people will find something else more inspiring and more useful. So this doesn't matter. In the end, you'll develop all of these things. In talking about the Iddhipadas, the Buddha was, in a sense, kind of cashing in on a very kind of common fascination in the Indian religious scene with the performance of miracles of psychic power. And of course, if we're familiar with religions around the world, we know that it's not just in India that people are fascinated with these things. Actually, most people all around the world are fascinated with these things. And even though today we like to think of ourselves as being very rational and sophisticated, but still, there's so much of the modern religious scene, even the New Age scene and all of these kinds of things, which is really just talking about various kinds of psychic abilities and so on. So I think if you look deeply in any kind of authentic religion or spiritual path, then they will, all of them, marginalize the importance of these kinds of things. Certainly, for example, in the Christian sphere, in the Gospels, you look in the Gospels, there's all kinds of miracles and that. But for most sophisticated Christians, don't make a big deal out of those things. They're not particularly important for their own religiosity. In fact, for the Christians, it's always a bit embarrassing because they want to try to explain things kind of scientifically and so on, but they have a problem with all of these performance of these psychic abilities. And within a Western or Christian framework, performance of psychic powers is essentially irrational within the Western framework. The reason being that the performance of psychic abilities is, performance of miracles, is supposed to be accomplished by something reaching in from outside the world. So like the hand of God, as it were, reaching through the sky or the heaven or something and doing something on the earth. Reaching from the other side, from behind the veil, somehow, and doing something on the earth. And this is one of the things that one of the agendas that modern science has always been trying to overthrow. So we shouldn't think that science is something that's kind of neutral or has just come up in a historical vacuum. The answers that science gives us are specifically intended to refute certain particularly Christian ideas. And for example, the laws of thermodynamics, which were developed in the 19th century, were specifically developed in order to refute the idea that someone like a god or something like that could reach their hand in from outside the universe and do things. And there was a group of scientists who made this their pledge that they would explain the world without reference to any of these kinds of metaphysical things. And they felt so strongly about it, they wrote a declaration and signed it in their own blood. Yeah? They signed it like pirates with their own blood. They're going to, for once and for all, completely eradicate any kind of metaphysics, any need for gods and souls and all of these kinds of things. And so the law of thermodynamics, every action has a equal and opposite reaction. Yeah, that means if I push this cup, then there's a reaction, the cup pushes in the reaction. So if God reaches his hand from outside the universe, where is he standing? Yeah? If God isn't standing anywhere, if he doesn't have anything to stand on, then he can't move things, he can't affect things in the world. Now, this is a very powerful argument against the performance of these kinds of miracles. They're irrational. They don't make sense in terms of what we can see, how the world works. So for this reason, anybody working within a Western framework, Western philosophical framework, always has a great difficulty with these. And we tend to associate rationalism or modernism with getting rid of these things, eradicating belief in miracles, psychic events, psychic powers, and so on, because it's felt to be fundamentally incompatible with a rational way of explaining the world. It's important that we understand this, because in Buddhism, the point of view is exactly different. Okay? It's exactly not that. And because the point of view, the idea of what a miracle is or a psychic power is not what the Christian idea or the Western idea of it is, then these arguments against it have nothing to do with it. They're completely irrelevant. Okay? And it's very important to know that, because there are some modernist Buddhists who, you know, get embarrassed by talk about psychic powers and miracles and so on in Buddhism, and like to try to explain them away, because they've been so influenced by this kind of Western model that they think somehow there's something wrong with it. So for Buddhism, these kinds of abilities, not something which is like reaching out from outside the world. It's not like some ghostly metaphysical hand which is standing in another dimension, reaching in to do things in this dimension. But they're caused by a manifestation of very ordinary qualities, very ordinary abilities, which each person sitting here in this room has. They are things which are here already. They're things which stand on the ground of truth. They stand on the ground of our own experience. So this is like the answer to the question of, you know, if God is reaching his hand in to do things in the world, what ground does he stand on? Well, this is the ground that he stands on. He stands on the ground of experience. Again, from a Western point of view, they sometimes talk about this idea of mind over matter, as if that's something very mysterious, that mind can control matter. We only think that this is mysterious when we've erected this idea that somehow mind is separate from matter in the first place. We erect this gulf between mind and matter so that we have that divorce between the inner world of experience and the external world, this kind of divorce, which we call mind-body dualism. So if we've erected this divorce, then we have this problem of the ghost in the machine. We've got this kind of ghostly apparition of this mind or this soul, which is somehow supposed to control this heavy machine that we have. And so somehow it seems very mysterious. But of course, mind controlling and affecting matter is happening constantly. Yeah? As each one of you is sitting there, your minds are affecting your bodies. Your minds have decided to sit down in a certain place, in a certain way. Your mind is aware of what's going on. Your mind is moving your head back and forth, or moving your eyes back and forth, moving your arms up and down. Your mind is controlling your breathing and your heartbeat. Your mind is doing all of these things constantly. So the reality that we experience is not of a separation of two separate entities of a mind and a body. The experience we experience is this world which has these qualities or aspects both physical and mental. So this world of experience has the mind built into it at the most fundamental level. If the mind is not there, then the world of experience doesn't exist. So to develop these psychic powers is nothing extraordinary. It's just an extension of the ordinary abilities that we have in our mind. It's not the invoking of some kind of deity. It's not the performance of some kind of magical ritual. It's not dependent on some kind of grace of the universe, some kind of special gift which is accessible to some people and not to others. It has nothing to do with any of these things. It has simply to do with developing qualities of the mind. So the point being, of course, that it is the mind itself, these qualities of the mind, that are, in fact, the extraordinary, amazing things in the world. Amazing things in the world is not magic. Magic is boring. Magic is the most mundane, bog-ordinary rubbish which has constituted the kind of the substratum of human thought and thinking for countless thousands of years. Any village that you go to in any underdeveloped third world country where people have no education, no literacy, no philosophy, that's what they do. They do this kind of magic stuff. And you should all read about magic and learn about it, find something out about it, because it's utterly banal. And we have this kind of idea that there's something special about it, that somehow, you know, there's something mysterious, because we're not taught about it at school. So it's like, it's almost like this hidden subject. So we get all excited about it, and we think, oh, Aleister Crowley and all of these kinds of things, and we go, it's magic and blah, blah, blah. And when you see when monks go to Thailand and they sort of, you know, people are doing these things, and people get into it and that. But magic is utterly banal and meaningless. So you should all learn about it. What is it? Why do people do it? So we can realize why the Buddha ignored it and why he said, just get on with the real stuff. And the same with like invoking deities. You know, it doesn't matter who the deity is. You know, if you go to any kind of village anywhere in the world, then they'll be doing some kind of puja. And as the Buddha said that in the small villages there'll be small devas, and the medium-sized villages there's medium-sized devas, and the big towns and there's big devas. Yeah, and that's exactly what you see. You go to these little villages, they'll have their little shrines, and they'll invoke these little nagas or yakas or little village spirits or whatever's living in the area. They come and help us solve all my problems. Make the rice grow. Make the buffaloes work harder. Make my children do the right thing at school. Make my husband stop beating me up. Whatever it might be. And then you go to the medium-sized towns and they have medium-sized churches and medium-sized gods. You go to the big towns and they have big churches and big gods. And it's always the same. And it's always totally and utterly banal. And has no interest or worth whatsoever for your spiritual development. It's complete waste of time. If we look back in history, you see that this idea of prayer or invoking a deity for things, it has these two elements, two aspects. One, butter them up. Two, ask for something. That's it. That's the formula. Very, very simple psychology. First of all, I'm going to give you something that you want. Pray. Oh, God and the Most Highest. Rather, oh, this give offering, incense. And all of these things. Secondly, oh, new Mercedes. Lottery. And that's what it is. It is that banal. This is what they call spiritual materialism. It is this utterly crude exchange. I give you some stuff, you give me more stuff. Yeah? I give you a little bit of stuff, you give me lots of stuff. If you're going to think like that, then just go and play the stock exchange. It's got the same spiritual value. And you're more likely to get what you want out of it. Yeah? Completely banal. The first prayer is a very fascinating sculpture from about 12 or 1300 BC in Assyria, to Kulti Ninurta, this vicious barbaric warlord who used to go around, who was like one of the first generations in those times. Before that time, they never had this knowledge of people who go around killing and so on. They just didn't seem to get into it. But the Assyrians around that era were the first people who were known to be really kind of these rampaging barbaric killers, going around slaughtering thousands and conquering and raping and pillaging wherever they went. And there's this wonderful sculpture of Tukulti-Ninurta, and it's like the first prayer. And if you see old pictures of gods, and say from Egypt and things like that, usually what you see is that the god is sitting, usually on a chair like I'm sitting on now, and the king is standing in front of the god on eye-to-eye level. So the king's like standing there looking straight at the god, like that. And in this sculpture of Tukulti-Ninurta, about 1200 BC, where you see three figures, three images. First image on the left is the king standing, just as he was in all of the earlier sculptures. But then you see a second image of the king. Okay, so it's like this is like the first Disney movie, the first animation. Yeah, he's actually changed. Yeah, it's the first. He actually represents time. He's moved from one to the other. Before he was standing, now he's kneeling on one knee. Yeah, so before he was standing very proud, like the king that he is. Now he's kneeling on one knee, and he's before the throne of the god. But whereas in all the earlier ones, the god was sitting in his throne, now there is no god. He's kneeling before an empty throne. Yeah? This is the first prayer. Get down on your knees and you pray to a god who is not there. He's somewhere else. Where has he gone? And then all through the years, you can see that prayer always has that same form. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And so you butter them up. Yeah, all these things. And they say, give us this day our daily bread. Yeah? How much cruder can you possibly be? I want to eat my bread today. And forgive us our trespasses. Yeah, whatever we've done wrong, you just forgive them. Yeah? You kind of really cross them off the slate. Yeah? This is what it is. This is what prayer is. So that these kinds of things, these kinds of religious ideas, about magic and also prayer, again, I repeat, are utterly banal, and they have no place in any genuine spiritual practice. Certainly they have no place in Buddhism. And this is why even Archbishop Peter Carnley said, when my mother went to see him give a mass in Perth, and he just said to everybody, he said, God doesn't answer your prayers. The Archbishop of all of Australia in the Anglican Church. He told everyone, God doesn't answer your prayers. They're all a bit disappointed by that. Because it's not what the kind of, even for a Christian, even if you put yourself in a Christian point of view, it's not the kind of thing that God is. God isn't sitting up there in a desk, you know, checking his emails every day, who's asked for prayers, and then sort of, you know, making, arranging everyone to sort of get the Mercedes that they want, and someone else gets the BMW they want, and someone else gets a good mark in their HSE or whatever. It's not the kind of thing which God is, and it's not the kind of thing that he does. So anybody who's looking at their religion from a genuinely spiritual way will not be interested in these things. So again, you should take time to learn about these things, because you will find, of course, that there's so much of it in Buddhism. This is not just other religions that have these things, because Buddhism is full of it, rife with it. And for many Buddhists, probably the vast majority of Buddhists, that's about all that it comes to. That's about all there is these like performance of magic rituals and performance of supplicatory prayer, trying to get stuff. Go down lights and draw six. New Mercedes. So these aren't the way to spiritual success. Yeah? So if you want to reach this kind of success or spiritual power, this is not the way. So the way the Buddha said develop these iddhipadas. Pari, chanda, virya, citta, vimamsa. Again, very ordinary. Chanda, meaning enthusiasm, desire, interest, aspiration. Virya, energy, heroic effort. endeavor, striving, not giving up. Citta, awareness. You've all got a citta, okay? You've all got some kind of awareness. And you've all got quite reasonably highly developed kinds of cittas in the scheme of things, believe it or not. Might not feel very highly developed. But anybody who's got like an interest in Dhamma and aspiration for it can actually, you know, want to spend some time meditating and learning and studying the Dhamma, has already got a very highly developed citta. So it's great. We've got somewhere to start from. And then we monksize investigation, inquiry. All of these things are good things. So you notice that they have like an aspect of energy. They're quite it's quite a powerful kind of practice, these four Iddhipadas. It's quite an active practice. It's something you can do with your mind. And so in that sense, it's something which is very useful for applying in everyday life. And you can use these things, and you should use these things as like a reflection in how you're doing things. For example, like, you know, very often we hear talk about, you know, people practicing mindfulness in everyday life, and of course that's very important. But also, don't forget these other things. You know, sometimes if we want to try to be mindful every moment of the day, it's very difficult. But these other things, like say, just have that attitude, it's like a positive attitude, an enthusiastic attitude. That's something that we can do. It's not as hard as being mindful every second of the day. But to just bring like an attitude of positive enthusiasm to whatever we're doing. Just a mind which says, yes, I can do that. And, you know, you try, even if you do like I did this morning and make a botched job and end up just cutting up your fingers and breaking the tools, and at least you at least you got the right attitude in breaking the tools. And you can develop that. I mean, it's amazing how you see different people with these. I remember I was doing this job once in Thailand, and we were doing some work, and I was staying at a branch monastery, and there was a group of monks there, and we had to do fix up the hall and these kinds of things. And it's very funny because there was this kind of group of monks we were working with, and particularly just remember these two monks. One of them was this, you know, American ex-lawyer, real kind of can-do character. Right, we'll get this and we'll get it done. And then the other one was this kind of skinny, morose Englishman. It was always kind of, you know, this kind of negative and depressed and. Yeah, it's good. You'd be doing exactly the same thing, you know, and one of them would be having this kind of nervous breakdown and getting depressed and, oh, it's impossible, it's rubbish, oh, it's awful. And the other one would just be, yeah, all right, let's get it, look. It's the mind, you know, the thing is exactly the same, the situation is the same, you know, you've got a job to do, there it is, you've got certain materials, you've got certain tools, you've got a certain thing you need to fix, you've got a group of people to do it with. Certain time constraints, all that situation is the same. And the attitude, a different attitude of people, it's quite amazing. So it's always, you know, it's always nice to be around people who have this kind of chanda, have this enthusiasm. If you say, you know, could you do this job? They say, yeah, sure, no problems. And bring that attitude of just trying to do things. And so that's something that I've always tried to develop as a monk. I mean, when I was a novice, I remember once when I was a novice and sitting at Watnanachar, there was like 20 monks there, and one time the Ajahn asked, there was a simple job that they were doing, and the Ajahn asked, and all the monks just sat there, can anyone do this job? And all the monks just kind of sat looking at the guy next to them. So I made a determination then that I would always volunteer whenever the Ajahn asked if there was a job. So that's what I did, whenever there was a job going, I was just put my hand up, say, yeah, I'll do that. Until eventually they started saying, you're already doing too much. I said, who else can do it? Because it kind of helps to create this kind of positive energy both in the community and also in your own mind. You have that energy, you have that kind of vibe. So don't be, you know, mistaken in believing that Buddhism says you should get rid of desire, yeah? The Buddha never said you get rid of all kinds of desire. He said you get rid of yayam tanha pono bhavita, which of course those people in our Pali class will know what it means, yeah? Huh? Yayam tanha is that craving, pono bhavita, which leads to further rebirth, yeah? That craving which is bound up with further rebirth. Nandi Raga Sahagata, together with relishing and lust. Tatra Tatra Abhinandini, delighting here and there. That is to say, Kama Tanha, sensual desire, Bhava Tanha, craving for existence, and Vibhava Tanha, craving for non-existence, for annihilation. These three kinds of craving the Buddha told us to get rid of. But he didn't say to get rid of Dhamma Chanda, the desire for the Dhamma, Dhamma Kama, Dhamma Raga, lust for the Dhamma, passion for the Dhamma. Yeah? So you should always be passionate about your Dhamma practice. Yeah? Never be too equanimous about your Dhamma, but be passionate about it. If you think that something's Dhamma, then you'd be passionate about it. If you think something's not Dhamma, then you'd passionately condemn it. At least it makes for good conversations in the monastery. And you've got to care about these things. If you don't care, then what can you do? Everything will just pass you by. You have to care about the Dhamma. You have to want to be able to give everything to it. Right, this kind of chanda, there's this kind of sense of, as long as you have this chanda, we have this. It's still incomplete. It's not a fulfilled state of being. Still an incomplete state of being. It's like we still feel like I'm here, and that there's something else. I'm in the mud, and there's that beautiful mountain peak. Let's get there. So there's like this, almost like this tension or this pressure, this differential between one and the other, and so that creates movement. When there's that pressure difference, and there's an energy behind it, there's a wanting to move. So there's that craving, is that wanting to move. So if you want to move towards the Dhamma, then that's right craving, right desire, that pressure, moving. I want to go there. This potential, that's important to get this and to sustain it, not just to have it bits and pieces, but to sustain it so that it becomes a part of your being, becomes a part of how you are and who you are. The second one of these is energy. Virya literally means heroism. So this is the hero. And you know what's the nature of the hero? It was discussed by Frodo and Sam as they're approaching Mordor, or even in Mordor. And they summed it up very well. It's like, you know, do you think somebody is going to tell our story one day? Yeah? Is someone going to tell our story? The story of nine-fingered Frodo and the Ring of Doom. But it's the ones who turn back. Their story doesn't get told. Yeah? The ones who gave up. The ones who didn't make it. They're not the heroes. Yeah? It's only if you keep going. If you keep going. If you keep going, then no matter who you are, even if you're only half the size of a human being, even if you're a hobbit, then if you just keep going, you think, I don't have any energy, but surely you're stronger than a hobbit, aren't you? And you can keep going, keep going, keep going. And that's where that heroism is. It's just not giving up, no matter what happens. Because you can't, because there's no alternative. What's the alternative? There's no going back. And just like Frodo and Sam in that story, they couldn't just say, no, sorry, we've tried hard enough, I'm just going to give back, I'm just going to go back to the Shire now and have a nice life. You can't do that. If they don't continue with what they're doing, everything's going to end. And this is a metaphor for each of our lives. If we don't practice, everything is going to end. We don't have a choice. You can't give up. You can't just say, sorry, okay, I tried Dhamma and it didn't work. Now I'm going to go back and just have an ordinary life again. Sorry, that door is shut. Or rather, through seeing the Dhamma, then you, through understanding Dhamma, you realize that it was just an illusion in the first place. There never was that place of safety. All there is a choice between, do you have a pit of burning coals to fall into, or do you have like a pit of frozen ice to fall into? That's your kind of your choice in your life. You don't have any choice to give up and go back to a place of safety. Our only choice in the Dhamma is just to keep on going. Just to keep on going, 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 going. Keep on going. Never give up. Never give up. No matter what happens, no matter what difficulties there are. You know, like we think that energy is hard to get. We have this idea that energy is a scarce resource. We have to pay $1.30 a litre to buy petrol to stick in our cars. We think, oh, somehow, you know, it's really hard to find energy. That's complete rubbish. The whole world is made of energy. Energy isn't a scarce resource. There's just so much energy everywhere. Everything around you now is just made of energy. You're surrounded by super dense, compacted energy. Any physicist will tell you that. That's the same in your mind. Your mind is nothing more than like a node or a compaction of mental energy, of conscious energy. That's all there is. So when you contact that energy, you're contacting also the truth, also the nature of the mind, because the nature of the mind is that energy. So this is why the wirya iti-pada is also very close to the citta. Because when you have energy in the mind, energy is like a brightness. When you have the energy flowing through the light bulb, the electricity flowing through the light bulb, it lights up, becomes bright. That's why like these LED globes are a very good analogy for that, because we know that they're made of just like a silicon chip, which you can use to process things. It's like the kind of the mind when you're processing things. But when you put an electric current through and it's tuned to the right frequency, it'll actually glow. So that's like information or consciousness glows. It sends out a light. And that glow, that light, is what we call the citta. So maybe we can turn the lights off and see what everyone's cittas look like. Not that kind of light. And it's a light you can see inside your minds. It's a light you can see when you're sitting in your kuti in the middle of the night and there's no moon and the clouds are covering the stars. There's a beautiful passage in the Upanishads, which I've read out a few times at the sutta class, when Yajnavalkya is talking with King Janaka of Mithila. And Yajnavalkya had previously made a pledge that he would always answer the questions. Anything that King Janaka asked him, he would always answer. But for some reason, he didn't want to answer these questions. He wanted to keep quiet. So the king kind of tried to keep on getting him to answer these questions, and Yajnavalkya kept on trying to evade it. So the first question was, what is the light of a person? And Yajnavalkya said, it's the sun. The king said, oh, very good, Yajnavalkya. It's a very good answer. Thank you for that. He said, but what happens when the sun goes down? He said, well, you know, when the sun goes down, the moon is the light. Because, you know, when the moon's up in the sky, you can walk around and see where you're going. He said, oh, okay, that's a very good answer. Thank you for that. That's made that very clear to me, yeah? He said, well, what happens when there's no moon? He said, well, then the stars are your light. Because even when the stars are out, you can see a little bit around what's going on. He said, oh, sadhu, sadhu, Yajnavalkya, that's a very profound answer. Thank you for that. But what happens when the sky is covered with clouds and you can't see the stars? What is the light of a person then? Yajnavalkya said, well, you get an LED headlamp. I didn't actually say LED headlamp. That was just a bit. I just put that in there just to modernize the story. But you get like a torch, a flaming torch, lamp. And then you can see by that. Janaka says, oh, sadhu, sadhu. Wonderful answer. But he says, what happens when there's no sun and there's no moon and there's no stars and there's no torch? There's no lamp. What then is the light of a person? Finally, Yajnavalkya is backed into a corner. He can't get out of it. And finally he says, when there's no sun and there's no moon and there's no stars and there's no torch, at that time then the self is the light of a person. So for these sages in the Hindu or Brahmanical tradition, this is what they took to be the self, is that antarajyoti, that inner light. So in Buddhism we talk about this inner light, but we don't call it a self, we just call it the mind. And the mind has this nature of awareness. So when you have that energy there, then it lights up. And you can see that. There's always some light there. If there wasn't any light, you couldn't see anything at all. If there wasn't any light in your mind, You'd be like the man who's walking outside and there's no sun and there's no moon and there's no stars and there's no torch. You could see anything, it'd be pitch black. The fact that you can see something in your mind means that there's some light there. That light is the light of the citta. So whereas for the Hindu or Upanishadic sages, the attainment of that light was like the end of the road, but for Buddhism, the attainment of that light is in order to set yourself up for, to investigate, to understand. And so this is why the vimamsa happens at the end, as inquiry, vimamsa. Of course, inquiry into cause and effect. And this vimamsa is taught in a very beautiful sutta called the Vimamsaka Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha teaches the monks to investigate him. He's not like one of these teachers who tells you, you have to believe everything I say on faith, and you know, you can't question anything I say, and all of that kind of thing. No, he told them. He gave this a whole sutta where he tells them how to investigate him. Listen, you have to check everything that I do. Do I teach you to abandon greed, but then I have greed myself? Yeah? You check me out. Is there anything that I'm doing that looks like I'm acting out of greed? Yeah? Or hatred, or delusion? Am I teaching in one way and then practicing another way? You have to keep on checking and inquiring that. Yeah? So this is the quality we monks are. So this is what we have to do. You know, we are told, the Buddha tells us, you know, abandon greed, hatred and delusion, and then you'll be happy. So you have to investigate that. Don't take it on faith. Is that true? When you have greed in your mind, does that make you happy? Or does that not make you happy? Investigate that. Learn about it. Understand it. Don't just give yourself a hard time because you feel greedy or angry. You don't think, oh, I feel angry, I'm a terrible person. Oh, and you make yourself even worse. And you keep on going around this downward spiral and go, oh, I'm just so terrible. Oh, I'm so angry. Oh, I'm getting terrible. And then you go off and cut your head off or something like that. You've got to investigate it. It's just the nature of the mind. When you have those kinds of things, you have greed, hatred and delusion, then the mind's obscured and clouded and darkened. When you don't have them, and the mind is bright and clear and happy. So this is the function of this vimamsa. It's quite interesting that in the description of these Iddhipadas, the Buddha gave like a formula for describing them. And each one of these things is said to be the basis of samadhi. So chandam nisaya labhati samadhi labhati cittase kagatam, dependent on chanda, on aspiration, then one gains samadhi, one gains one-pointedness of mind. Dependent on virya, dependent on citta, dependent on vimamsa, one gains samadhi, one gains one-pointedness of mind. So this is very strongly emphasized through these four Iddhipadas, gaining of samadhi. And when we talk about gaining samadhi, we're talking about kind of deeply transformed consciousness, a state of stability and clarity and unification of the mind. That kind of state, again, is not a magical thing. It's not something which you can be given by some deity or even by some bodhisattva or some cosmic Buddha or anything like that. They can't come along and take hindrances out of your mind and put samadhi in there. Yeah, it doesn't happen. It's not like that. Even the Buddha couldn't do that when he was alive. Even if you were here today, sitting here, and it wasn't me sitting here, if it was the Buddha sitting here teaching you, even he couldn't do that. And this is specifically what he said in the Sola Sapanha. He said, I'm not able to help people across if they're still having doubts and they're still having defilements in the mind. I can't do it. There's nothing I can do. You know, and even if you have people, you know, monks have these kind of psychic abilities and things like that. You know, what? It doesn't do them any good. You can't help people if they're not willing to practice. Like this Thai monk who was living up in the north of Australia, and, you know, someone came on to see him and they asked about their son. They said, I want you to help my son. And the monk sort of said, your son, he's living in a very small room surrounded by lots of other small rooms. And then she said, yes, he is. He's in jail. He said, well, he's done lots of bad things in the past. She said, yeah, that's true. And he's going to do lots of bad things in the future. And he doesn't want to meditate and there's nothing I can do to help him. So what can you do? There's nothing you can do. Someone doesn't want to practice. It's up to your own effort. If you do that and you gain this, you can do all kinds of amazing things. You can, you know, the possibilities are endless. You know, you get these kind of standard lists of psychic powers and things that talked about in the suttas, walking on water and diving into the earth as if it was water and all of these kinds of things. You know, if you hang around Buddhist circles long enough, then you get to hear stories of people who can do these kinds of things. And like the monk I was just talking about, you know, we've heard this story before, most of the people were about, and he was asked to help. There was a young Sri Lankan boy who was very badly injured in a car crash, smashed his car, put in the hospital, driven to hospital, and was pronounced dead twice on the way to the hospital while he's in the ambulance. His heart stopped beating and just got revived. He rushed into the hospital, massive internal injuries. That's how bad he was. He was dead twice already and revived into the hospital. The family rang for this monk. The monk came in and he did his stuff. I don't know what his stuff is. I don't know what it is exactly that he did. But whatever it was, it blew up all the monitors and electric equipment in the hospital room. And the guy got better. He recovered. And afterwards, one of our friends who'd been here to visit here spoke to him and said, "Oh, Prajan, you know, I'll give you a call later." And he said, "No, you can't call me anymore." She said, "Why not?" She said, he said, "My mobile phone, no good." He said, "What happened?" She said, "Oh, it melted." He melted his mobile phone. You know, that was the kind of energy that he was putting out. And I said, "Well, what does the hospital think about this kind of behavior?" They said, "Well, they're used to him by now, but they just make him do his, it has to do it in an empty room, you know. Can't do it in a room with other things in it." So, you know, people can do these kinds of things, you know. And you hear many stories in the forest tradition. It's like Umpul Chok. And his many tricks that he would do, one of his favourite ones was the old trick with the very small teapot and the very big teacups. You've got kind of these little tiny teapots like that, and you've got all these people with the big teacups, and you keep on refilling them time and time again. And with the same teapot. And Limpul Wan, he had this one, he was seen once sitting in meditation by a fighter pilot. Flying through the clouds, 10,000 feet. Oh, there's a monk there. Oh. What's going on? Flies around, sort of sees this monk sitting there in the middle of the sky. This is in about 1972, during the time of the Vietnam War. And he immediately flew back to base, jumped in his car and drove to where he'd seen this monk flying around. And asked the villagers there, he said, "Are there any special monks in this area?" And they said, "Oh, you must be in Limpul Wan." And he was this monk who was just living by himself, just unknown at the time. He became very well known very soon after that event. Yeah, it was like all over the newspapers and stuff in Thailand. A very well known event. And many stories that you can hear. So in Thailand they will do these kinds of things, but of course, you know, they have an appreciation that these things aren't, you know, they're not really Dhamma. And when we were, I went to see my teacher Ajahn Chachai one time with my friend Ajahn Chandiko, and Ajahn Chachai said to Ajahn Chandiko that he should, when he's finished meditation, he should make a determination that if anybody's died recently, that maybe they appear to me, so you can like see the departed, anyone who's lingering in the area. And, you know, you can kind of see them, and that will give you like a, you know, you might have faith in these ideas of rebirth and so on, but you can actually see for yourself, so you won't have just a faith that you actually know. And Ajahn Chandiko said, "Well, how do you tell? How do you know that it's not just imagination?" He said, "Well, when you see that, then you have to then make inquiries in the local area about anyone who's passed away recently, and to find out if anyone has passed away, and then... you know, about who they were and what they looked like and these kinds of things, so you can verify it." And so Ajahn Chandiko said, Go ahead and chat to me. Have you ever done this yourself? And he said, oh, yeah, I did it so often I got bored with it. So this is, you know, people do these things, but it's not, you know, it's not really the heart of the Dhamma. So in Thai they call them kien len, which means playthings. Yeah. So this is your playthings that you can mess around with, keep you entertained, keep you amused. But it's not the same as insight into the Dhamma. But there's nothing wrong with it. The Buddha never really condemned them. But what he condemned was the kind of misuse of psychic abilities. So just remember that whatever these things happen, these psychic abilities, of course, they're very difficult to verify. Obviously, in any particular case, it's difficult to know, is that story true or is that not true? We can't know that. Some cases they seem more plausible than others. But even in those, I heard that Ajahn Bhikkhu, who's one of the most accomplished monks in the tradition of Ajahn Chah, apparently he said something that along the lines that, you know, even for the very advanced practitioners, that their psychic abilities are not like always 100%. They can't always predict everything. And or they might not always be right all the time. So always remember that. That's very important. And there's a very good story about a monk who's a friend of mine, was staying in northern Thailand in a village, outside of a village in the forest, and staying in a kuti for the rains retreat. And during that rains retreat, he had very good meditation. And he's an Australian monk. He was having very good meditation, and he would, from time to time, he would have like this vision or this knowledge that something was going to happen in the future. And it would just come to his mind. So sometimes it might come to his mind, oh, so-and-so is going to come and visit me at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And so at 4 o'clock he'd put his robe out and go out to meet the person and see him. And at 4 o'clock the person would come. And then one time he had this kind of knowledge came to him, oh, tomorrow morning such and such a person in the village is going to invite me to Dana at their house on Saturday morning. And they're going to pick me up at 9 o'clock at my kuti. So he's going for arms round. And he got to that person's house, and the person said, oh, excuse me, Ajahn. And he just said, oh, no problems, I'll be waiting at 9 o'clock on Saturday if you can pick me up for the house dinner. And then he remembered, oh, he wasn't supposed to know that. Of course, the layman just kind of looked at his jaw dropped and like, how did you know that? Oh, well, and of course, his reputation spread very rapidly among the village after that. But these things, it's a kind of great pitfall for you know, for monastics, because everyone assumes that you know everything all the time, you know, and especially if anything like that happens, I mean, you can never get over it, you can never live it down. And, you know, I mean, what happens, and it's happened to me, where sometimes you'll be talking about something, and then somebody walks in, somebody comes up to you and afterwards and says, can you read my mind? I said, no. Sure, yeah, it was exactly what I was talking about with my friend just before we came here, or something like that. And so people are always kind of reading into what you're doing, so you have to be very careful. But with this monk, these things kept on happening for a while. But then after a while, something changed. Suddenly this knowledge would come in his mind, oh, tomorrow 2 o'clock, so-and-so is going to come and visit me. He'd put on his robe, he'd go out and sit there and wait, 2 o'clock comes, no one's there. Oops, what's going on? Yeah? So that's the power of craving that comes in. You get attached to it. You think you've got that thing. You think, I'm one who knows. I've got this knowledge. Craving comes in and it twists it. When that craving comes, it distorts it. So even though things can be true sometimes, not necessarily true all the time. You have to be very careful of that. So usually monks are very, or should be very restrained in how they're doing these things. They shouldn't be going off boasting about them and making displays and advertising them in the paper and these kinds of things. And but you know, some monks are human as well, so sometimes they'll say things that maybe they shouldn't. There was one time when Ajahn Bleeyan was giving a talk, and Ajahn Jnana was with him, and Ajahn Bleeyan was giving this talk about the Four Noble Truths. And during the talk, this woman came into the back of the room and started chatting away really noisily. Found one of her friends and started chatting away really noisily in the back of the room and disturbing everybody. And when Ajahn Bleeyan came to the bit, talking about the Four Noble Truths, he came to the bit about not getting what you want is suffering. And he said, yeah, he said, like that woman in the back of the room. This afternoon, she was driving along through the city and she passed a jewelry shop And she went into the jewelry shop and she saw this diamond ring, which she really likes. And she really wanted that diamond ring, but she hasn't got enough money to buy for it. So she thought she'd come here to my talk and ask me for a lottery number so she can win the lottery so she can buy her diamond ring. And she's going to suffer because I'm not going to give her a lottery number. And she just, woman just screamed and said, "Ah, oh my God, how do you know?" And sat there very quietly for the rest of the talk. I mean, Ajahn Bleen left with Ajahn Jnana after the talk. Ajahn Bleen said, "Oh, I shouldn't have done that," he said, "but she's just so annoying, I couldn't help myself." So, this is the practice of psychic powers. It's not magic, it's not something given to you by God or anything like that, but it's something which, it's not a special gift, it's just something which is a normal part of consciousness, it's a normal part of the mind. So, if you all practice that, then you can all do it. And there are plenty of stories in the suttas and in the tradition also of lay people who have those powers, not just the monks. There's even like the stories of the lay women who have the powers to read the minds when the monks come on arms round. And they read the minds of all the monks and they know who's the really well-practicing ones and who's the really greedy ones. And those kinds of things that happen. It's not just something you get because of your status, it just comes from how pure your mind is. Some people get them, some people don't. But that practice of the Udipadas is of course one of the fundamental Dhamma practices, so it doesn't just lead to psychic power, but it leads to liberation, leads to freedom, which of course is the only psychic power that really counts. So we can treat these kinds of abilities as like, they're kind of adornments of the mind, they're like optional extras. They're like kind of the jihi stripes you can put down the side of the mind, and they don't really affect it. They might make it a bit more fun along the way, but they're not really going to affect the overall path. But if you keep practicing these four Udipadas and keep using them to make your mind powerful, make your mind strong, then you can achieve that true psychic power of gaining freedom from suffering. So this is my talk to you this evening on the four Udipadas. So I offer that to you for your reflection. And I'd like to invite if anyone has any comments or questions. The mindfulness of the body specifically is like, you know, how are you directing your mind? Yeah, just through the breath and these kinds of things. So you have those qualities of Udipadas together with that. So they all kind of go together.
So when you're practicing mindfulness of the body, you don't have to specifically remember the four Udipadas, but just mindfulness of the body is enough.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I mean, the mindfulness of the body can encompass those, but you can use the four Udipadas are there. You can use to consciously evoke them if you want to. Yeah? And that, you know, especially for somebody who connects with that practice, yeah, or has a need for it, then they're there. But yeah, if you're, you know, just practice with mindfulness, then they will come, everything will come together eventually.
Just another question. Shrines. Paying homage to shrines. Would it be was it one of the seven that the Buddha asked people to do to keep the community together?
You mean the Aparihaniya Dhammas? It was one of the seven Dhammas which was taught to the Vajjis. To look after and keep respecting their ancient Vajjian shrines. But in the corresponding set which was made for the Sangha, it wasn't specifically said that it was a worshipping shrine, but I can't remember what it was substituted for something else. For people not aware of the background, at the beginning of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the last discourse, or the discourse of the last days of the Buddha's life, then the Buddha spoke of seven Dhamma's seven principles by which the Vajjayans lived, which kept them living together strongly and in harmony. And then after that, then he spoke of seven corresponding Dhammas, which the Sangha could also live by, which were related to those seven Dhammas of the Vajjayans, but not identical to them. In some cases were changed.
Would you go to say that for lay people it's important to have some kind of tribe?
I think it's useful, yeah. Create a sense of sacred space. And the Buddha always used to really like the shrines around. You know, he used to visit them and stay them, the tree shrines and things like that.
Okay. This is probably relevant to the topic that I recently saw a program on TV about near-death experiences.
Mm.
And there's some argument about it, and one argument says, you know, there is the research done recently on a person who was close to death, and then I think she had to have an operation or something. But instead of, you know, giving her total anesthetic, I think they just decided to shut down some of the elements of the brain so that it didn't function. They said, well, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But they found out that even after, you know, everything was shut down, she still experienced this immediate experience. And they started to speculate that maybe mind is separate from the brain. And so even after the brain stops functioning, the mind can still.
Okay. Of course.
And is it like what is defined as nimitta?
As a nimitta? Yeah, it was very similar to like a samadhi nimitta. And yeah, you could call them nimittas, the visions that people have. Well, they do. They are called nimittas, yeah.
That's not what happens when you experience the jhana or, you know, have a sense of bliss, right, in the meditation.
Yeah, I mean,
that were interviewed on TV, they just, you know, they were close to death and they had, you know, they had no devotion or any spiritual values beforehand.
Right.
Were close to dying, and then it just happened. It, you know, they felt a sense of bliss and
It all comes from letting go, and letting go of the body. Letting go of attachment to life, and that's what creates the kind of a sense of bliss and life in the light in the mind. The same word, in Pali, the same word nimitta is used to describe those experiences as to describe a samadhi experience. They talk about different kinds of nimittas in the Pali. They have the gati nimitta, which is the nimitta of the destiny, where you're going to go. Yeah, so like a vision appears in your mind of where your next destiny is going to be. So someone's lying on the bed and they start screaming and thrashing around saying, "Nah!" Maybe you haven't had a very good gati nimitta. other ones they have is like the kamma nimitta. You have like a vision of your kamma, which is going to actually propel you into the next life. Like a memory of that act that you've done. Actually going to come into your mind. So different kinds of nimittas can happen. And they certainly share a lot in common with the samadhi nimitta. So I mean, one way of looking at it is to say when you're practicing samadhi, you're practicing for dying. Yeah? You're learning what that's like. So when the time comes, so the Buddha says if you do these things, you die unconfused. That's always one of the benefits of samadhi practice. You're not confused because you're not, it's just normal. It's just, here we go again. Yeah. I met talk before about that kind of idea of the mind and the body, and this is why, from a Western perspective, it's like, you know, you can't, it's so puzzling, because you're coming from a perspective of kind of a mind-body dualism, where you think that mind is completely different from the body. So like, you know, traditional Western philosophy from the time of Plato has got this mind-body dualism. You've got the soul on one side and the body on the other. So the science comes along and says, no, this isn't real, and only this one is real. Yeah. And they think they can prove something from the fact that there's correlations between mental stuff and brain stuff, and somehow that proves that there's no such thing as a mind. I mean, this is a kind of bizarre reasoning, that because there's a certain physical things happening, that therefore the mental things are not real somehow, yeah, or are less real, or something like that. Well, it shows that there's a certain relationship. This is what Buddhism's always said, that the mind and the body are codependent. Yeah, they're always interconnected at every level. So wherever you look at it, wherever you kind of poke it, you'll always find the mind and the body, this physical and mental aspects of that. Yeah? But that body at the time of death, after death, there's still a physical aspect to that. Yeah? So there's like a separation from the body in terms of the this kind of thing here, but there's still a physical dimension to that. Even though it might be more subtle, you could think of it like as an energy or something like that, an energy body. But that energy carries like a, it's still conditioned. So it's not a self, it's still conditioned. It's conditioned by the energy of this body. Yeah? Just like if you have a light switch or something like that, you know, you can switch off the light and the light will still stay glowing for a while. Yeah, it's still got the momentum, it's actually conditioned. The actual energy now isn't going there, but it's still conditioned and it still stays there. Because it's the same, like the mind has a certain momentum which we build up because of our karma and so on. And even when it's separated from the body, in that what we call the antarabhava, the in-between stage, even though it's not kind of getting additional fuel, it's still kind of sustained by that kind of power of craving which has been built up over the whole life, and it sustains the power of craving for it to pass from one interval to the other. So it's like that spark, which kind of moves from one lifetime to the next. And that's exactly the image that the Buddha used, of like this spark that flies off and then gets embedded in the new thing, new fire. Yeah. No, it's a good question, though. And it's one which... some discussions of dependent origination seem to miss that point. When we talk about psychic powers, of course, the most important ones are the ability to recollect your past lives and the ability to see, I call it the dibhachaku, to see the results of karma. Yeah? Now, when we talk about dependent origination, what we're talking about the structure of conditionality that underlies samsara or underlies rebirth. So in a sense, you're talking about the same kind of thing. You're talking about rebirth, past lives and future lives and how they happen. But the difference is that through using the psychic powers, what you see is the details of these things. You see the skin of that experience. You know, in my past life, I was born as Cleopatra. Or I was Napoleon, or whatever it may be. And you know where you were born, what your name is, and what food you ate, and all those kinds of things. And you can do it through those kinds of things, but you're remembering like the skin of experience. Yeah? And what dependent origination, understanding dependent origination, is not understanding that skin of experience, it's understanding the bones or the marrow of experience. So it's not concerned with those surface details. So you can understand dependent origination and you don't even know what your name was in your past life or where you were born or anything. You don't need to know any of those details. But what you do is you understand cause and effect. So you understand how it happens. Yeah, so that's the difference. That's what dependent origination is about. So and for me, a good analogy is like watching television. So recollecting past lives is like sitting in front of the television show and watching the show, yeah? So you can watch, and you know this is the program, and this is the characters, and this is the storyline, yeah? Whereas understanding dependent origination is like a TV mechanic who gets in the back of the TV set and can pull it all apart, and they know how it works, why you can have a show on the front. They might not know what program is being shown at all. They don't know anything about it, yeah? but they know how it is that this TV set can actually make a picture. Yeah? Different kind of knowledge.